Welcome again to Mormonland. It's the Salt Lake Tribune's podcast about LDS teachings and culture. I'm Dave Noyce. I'm a managing editor here at the Tribune and also the religion editor. I'm joined again by our senior religion reporter, Peggy Fletcher Stack. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Dave.
Our guest today was a trailblazer for women in Utah's legal system, most significantly as the first female justice on the Utah Supreme Court, including a decade as Chief Justice. After 35 years on the state's high court, Christine Durham stepped down last November. She's here today to discuss her faith, the intersection of religion with the law, and her professional association with a top Mormon leader. Justice Durham, and it's an honor to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Justice Durham, many of our listeners certainly know that you are a ceiling crasher for women and a strong feminist, yet they may not know that you're a Mormon, a believer in a patriarchal faith. How do you explain that?
I'm laughing because the question about how to explain faith reminds me of my college years when I read a lot of Kierkegaard, who talked about the phenomenon of faith as being beyond explanation. And I thought he was right then, and I continue to think he's right. I don't think that faith is something that lends itself to rational explanation. I think it has to do with the deepest core of human personality and its search for transcendence, for understanding and making meaning in a very uncertain world. As to the affiliation with an institution that has certain roots and certain values, that is always a matter of negotiation. And I think that I would explain my decision and lifelong affiliation with the LDS Church in terms of a series of negotiations.
So what was it like growing up as a Mormon? What was your home life like? What kind of Mormonism did your family practice?
Right. Well, actually, my father did not join the LDS Church until I was, I think, 8. And so I have family recollections of a time before my family's association with the church and then after. My mother did come from a family with LDS roots. The family joke used to be that her branch of the family got to Utah and decided to keep going to the real promised land, which was Southern California. So although she had some connection to the church as a child, she was not active beyond her early teenage years. So it was really my father's conversion that brought the family into the church. And I have to say, like many converts, my father was extremely devoted. And his transformation, his conversion, really generated a tremendous change in his life. And it also generated tremendous changes in my family's life. And I think the church and its structure and its programs and its service orientation always provided him and my mother and by extension the whole family a sense of connection and structure that was very important. My family traveled a great deal. We lived in Washington, D.C. for several years, and then we went to France for 5 years, and then after that I was gone from the family in college and so on, but my parents spent over 10 years in various countries in South America. And every place they went, they not only learned the languages, and they might have done that anyway, but one of the reasons they learned the languages was so that they could participate and serve in the context of LDS church activities. They always had a community of individuals, which gave them, it really provided a core, I think, for their lives. So although my father, you know, as a convert, he was perhaps a little rigid. That was the era where no playing cards in the family, no Coca-Cola. Some of you may be old enough to remember that. But that changed over the years. In fact, I used to tease him. In his old age, he got addicted to Diet Coke. And he and my mother used to play bridge in embassy circles all over Latin America. So they were devoted and dedicated, but they also weren't. There wasn't coldness in that. There was warmth and flexibility.
So when did you become a feminist, or what were you the same kind of believer as they were?
No, I don't think so. I think I was born with a skeptical streak in the middle of my temperament and personality. So I was always the questioning one, always the pushback one. But I think what happened was that, notwithstanding that skepticism and that pushback, I also saw the enormous benefits in terms of family life and in terms of orientation to service that the church provided in my family. So I think I grew up somewhat conflicted. I probably led most of my life somewhat conflicted, but I've been able to manage those negotiations by leaving some space around the things that I don't like or the things that I'm uncomfortable with, and keeping my gaze focused on the things that I know to be beneficial and meaningful.
You talk about negotiation with your faith and your own feelings. Can you give us an example of something you've had to negotiate?
Well, very clearly one of the huge problems that many, if not, I would hope that all, but I'm not sure, that many Mormons had to cope with was the church's historical stance on the question of blacks and the priesthood. And that was a source of great discomfort, great inclinations towards disaffection and lack of affiliation. And it's hard looking back to explain exactly why you stay close to an institution which engages in practices which are so deeply incompatible with what you feel and believe about Christianity. But there were generations of us who asked the questions, who had the discussions, who committed ourselves to beliefs that it would be changed, and stayed nonetheless. And of course, when the changes came, that was a cause for rejoicing, although I still think there's an element of shame that my church engaged in for so long in policies and practices that I think were incompatible with its basic mission. Nonetheless, I negotiated my way through it and I stayed.
Are there any policies today? For example, the November 2015 policy on gays. Did you have any trouble negotiating that one?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been, I think, fairly open in suggesting that I think that is a policy mistake along the same lines, if perhaps not with the same dimensions, as the historical position on priesthood extension. I don't think it's the right decision. Again, it has not to this point been one that would cause me to leave the church. There are too many ways in which I love the church, and I wish I should get correct date on this story, but there's a famous story about an individual who became disaffected with decisions Brigham Young was making, and at some point during an argument, he commented to Brigham Young that it was his church too, and he was going to stay, even though he thought that the decisions were wrong. And so that's I think what I hope for is to have a local impact, a sense within my family that being inside the church is a better place to work for the things that I think are right than being outside. Although that's a very difficult position for a Mormon because we're such a top-down institution in terms of the sources of information. But yes, that's one that is very difficult to deal with.
So getting to another issue that's confronting the church currently, of course, and has for a while, is the status of women in the church. You no doubt have some strong feelings on that, some people are advocating, of course, that women will never be equal unless they get the Mormon priesthood. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's interesting because the concept of equality in a religious context always has to be understood, I think, in terms of a relationship between the individual and the divine and with God. And to be honest, I don't think that the church's doctrine governs that relationship. Ultimately, what the church's doctrine on this question governs is the administrative power within the institution. And so there's a sense in which I don't think anyone can make women unequal in their relationship to God. I think some of the things the church does teach encourages the notion that there is a degree of inequality, and frankly, I just don't accept that. So I think a distinction has to be made between the question of spiritual status and access to blessings and access to a relationship in one's life that is personally sustaining. And I think that's different from the question of the role that women play in the church in terms of leaderships, policy decisions, and so on. I think that the patriarchy, which the church espouses, has ancient roots, and I think that the time will come when the particular structures which sustain the church in that path will change. I think it's a question somewhat similar to the question of the blacks and the priesthood. There were historical reasons why that doctrine emerged, and there are historical reasons why doctrines around gender have emerged. But Christianity as a whole has abandoned much of its early roots in terms of the way women participated in church governance. And I suspect eventually we'll catch up with that loss and start to repair it.
So in the short term, though, until that happens, what could you see? What do you think the LDS Church could do to better involve its women or, again, short of probably the priesthood issue, what else would you like to see?
The church has taken what I regard as some baby steps in terms of trying to make sure that women's voices are more consistently heard in councils at the local level. I've had so many experiences over my life where, going back decades, especially since we moved to Utah, where I would be invited to some kind of a discussion group or an advisory group meeting for one of the church auxiliaries or other kinds of, you'd call them maybe even focus groups, where Mormon women, particularly some of us who had high profiles, would be invited to talk to church leaders about, what do women want? And the problem is that every time we tell them what we want, which was to be heard and to have decision-making responsibilities and authority, you'd see a little bit of a short circuit. At the other end, our hierarchy is very strong, and I think it's going to take a long time to get women into that hierarchy. And frankly, until women enter that hierarchy at some more organized or structured level than they are now, I don't think women will be adequately heard. It is astonishing to me that the policies and practices that affect the lives of millions of church members, at least half of whom, probably more, are women and children, that all of those ultimate decisions are coming solely from policy-making bodies peopled by men. And I don't think that is a very effective way to address those needs. So I welcome the presence of women in local councils. Bishops are now being encouraged to ensure that the women's and children's auxiliary leaders are participating in those conferences. And, you know, anybody will tell you, if you want to go into a Mormon ward and find out what's really going on and who's in need and where the service orientation should be and so on, you don't necessarily ask the bishop's counselors or even the bishop. You better ask the Relief Society president, because she is the one who's likely to have her fingers on the pulse of the congregation in that regard. And so it makes all the sense in the world to me to involve that same Relief Society president in the decisions about what ought to be done.
You serve for a time.
Forward.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry, Justice Durham. You serve for a time on the Supreme Court with a person who's in the position to change some of those policy, Dallin Oaks, who's now a member of the church's first presidency, and he's next in line, you know, to actually lead the LDS Church in the succession. What was he like as a colleague on the court? You were there for like maybe a couple of years together?
Yes, we overlapped. I think it was three. It may only have been two. My memory fails me slightly in that regard. He was a wonderful colleague. I have to say that of the then members of the court, he was the one who made a real effort to help orient me to my work, to welcome me there. And I never experienced from him anything but the most open-handed and open-hearted respect and acceptance. He was a very worthy opponent intellectually. I really enjoyed working with him. He's an incredibly bright man, was a very accomplished lawyer, and of course, had been an educator and an administrator as well. I've never had a better colleague on the court than Dallin. The thing that I remember in particular was how funny he was. He's a born storyteller. I haven't seen as many. I haven't associated with him personally to any extent in the years since. So I would assume that characteristic still manifests itself in his everyday dealings and in private. I don't see it in his public persona as much as I used to see it on the court. A great storyteller, always made us laugh.
Do you see traces of his legal mind in his role as an apostle?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's an extent to which I refer to him privately as even though it's not his office or his calling, but there are ways in which I see him as the church's lawyer. He clearly seems to be the person who is helping to structure the messages that the church wants to deliver, to respond to ideas or movements or people who are perceived to be hostile to the church's message. He's the advocate. He performs that role as advocate in so many settings, and I've often thought that some of his public talks and speeches read almost like legal briefs. They're carefully constructed. They're clearly designed to advocate for a particular result. So, yes, I think he's played a significant, that his legal training and his legal mind have played a significant role in his work as an apostle.
So a lot of people see Dallin Oaks' fingerprints in what some have called the Utah Compromise, when the legislature several years ago passed LGBT protections in housing and employment, while also carving out some considerations for religious freedom. Do you think that law that the legislature passed would hold up if pressed in court, or what are your impressions of that?
Well, I think it served a significant sort of social justice purpose at the time it was negotiated and passed, in that it headed off some pretty ugly confrontations that were shaping up. To be honest, and notwithstanding the fact that I'm off the court, I don't think I'd want to offer an opinion on its viability in terms of implementation and constitutional success, partly because I just haven't studied it enough, and I also don't know a lot about the kinds of conflicts that may be brewing within it. It concerns me a little bit because, as I say, I thought that at the time it gave us breathing room around some of these issues, but I'm not entirely comfortable that we as Utahns, have used that breathing room in productive ways in terms of figuring out more long-term how open a society we're going to be and how accepting and tolerant of difference we are going to manage to be in the future. It's an arena in which Elder Oaks and I have very different perspectives. His work within the church and leading a global institution like that has clearly, in my view at least, led him to a view that religious liberty is under attack and that the church needs to create protections for itself and for other churches. My own perspective and my work has not ever persuaded me that religious liberty is significantly under attack, at least in this country. I don't speak globally because it's very different in many other places. But so I don't come to those problems from the same perspective he does.
So here's a personal question for you. As a person of faith and a lawyer, do you think the church has too many lawyers running it and that it's too legalistic in some ways? Do you, again, as a person of faith, wish for more, I don't know, pastoral speeches, sermons?
Well, that is a very interesting question. First of all, I really like lawyers. Not just because I am one, but I like lawyers. Typically, I think they're very curious people. I think they're problem-solving people. I know that there are ways in which the secular law performs very different function from ecclesiastical law. And I suppose it is possible that too many lawyers in the mix in leadership roles can interfere with, as you say, the pastoral impulse. But my own perception is that there's a fairly good mix on that. One of the other perspectives that I bring to all of this, I'm not a Jeffersonian in every respect, but I'm with Jefferson when you talk about drawing clear lines between secular society, which includes government, and the idea of ecclesiastical order and religious governance. I do not believe that we should import the dictates of faith into the secular law in terms of requiring people who may not share that faith to have to live by its tenets. And I suppose if I'm being perfectly fair, we should also say that you shouldn't be importing the process and procedures from secular law into religious law. And so maybe that's a risk that the church runs in trying to administer such a large population of membership. And I'm willing to concede it's a risk, but I don't know that I see it. I look at, and this is an area where Elder Oaks has written fairly extensively on the history of church law, ecclesiastical law, and the degree to which the church has set up processes and procedures for managing internal disputes and decision-making. And my own sense is that, again, it doesn't always have, you know, I think it's a problem, for example, that ecclesiastical courts within the church are peopled entirely by men. I think that's a problem. I think, you know, there's a concept we recognize in the secular law that when you're on trial, you have to be judged by a community of your peers. And that's a particular precept that the church has not incorporated into its courts. And of course, the response is, well, these aren't just courts of judgment, they're courts of love and rehabilitation and so on. But I still think that the judgment calls that have to be made would be better made if there were both genders on the panels.
So maybe one last sort of personal question, which is, you and your husband, George, he is a pediatrician, and you parented your children, your five children, together, taking on different roles than maybe the typical. How's that worked for you? And do you see yourselves as a kind of possible role models going into the future where more women are working outside the home, more men might be taking on some of those roles? Were you trailblazers?
Well, when George and I started doing it, there weren't very many examples. We graduated from graduate school in the early 70s, both of us, and launched our careers at that point. And we got a lot of pushback from family, from friends, from neighbors, from other church members, even about what we were doing. Questioning and curious, probably more than critical, although I think there were some critical eyes resting on us. But we were comfortable in our decisions and our choices. My sense now is that there are many more people. I'm surprised when I get acquainted with young lawyers, for example, to find out what they are doing in their families, and my former law clerks who go out into practice as young people. And just my observation is that they do seem to feel freer to work out their own family structure, to make their own decisions about parenting, about child care, about career development. That, of course, probably doesn't account. That's a self-selected group, and it probably doesn't account for many, many women in particular, and men as well, who sort of imbibe the notion that things have to be done a certain way, that women's place is at home with family and men's place is in the workforce supporting the family. So I worry a little bit that the messages are still there, and that they're still being heard, and that women are not fully, young women don't get the chance to fully consider who they are and what they want to be in terms of the choices they'll make. For George and me, it worked out great. We look at our children, we look at the kind of people they are, we look particularly at the kind of parents they are for those who have children, and we feel really comfortable with our choices.
So is life
easier? You'd have to ask them, I suppose, whether they're comfortable with our choices.
So is life easier in retirement for you now?
Well, it was supposed to be. And it's only been a few months, and we had an unfortunate accident in our family. Our youngest daughter, who has Down syndrome, was seriously injured.
Mm.
in January. And so right now, George and I are being full-time caretakers. And thank heavens I'm retired, or I would be hard-pressed to figure out a way to get everything done. But I am excited about the options and possibilities. One of the things I'm enjoying, I have to say, is for the most part, there are things I still don't feel comfortable talking about, but for the most part, I'm not constrained any longer by the censors that judges have to impose on expressing their opinions.
You're saying you wouldn't be here saying this if you were still on the court, right? Any of these things?
I might not.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time and your insights and wish you the best getting through this current predicament you're in helping your daughter.
Well, so good to talk to you, and I need to express appreciation, especially to Peggy, for all of the great work she does. I love reading her work in the paper and talking to her on any occasion.
Peggy is the best. We look forward to her coverage at sltrip.com, and we'll catch you again on Mormonland. Thanks.